Russell Hoban, who had...
I know Russell Hoban.
Yeah, he wrote Ridley Walker, was his last book. And he came in and he said, well, how long is your broadcast? And I said, well, it's it runs 2 minutes. He said, 2 minutes? He said, well, if I had known that, I never would have come here. I said, why? He said, well, we can't cover any ground in 2 minutes. And I said, well, you don't understand. I'm a broadcast journalist. I take the material. I edit it. Just imagine if we're speaking for an hour and nobody's going to carry it. It might run on a college FM station someplace with no audience, but here I'm on 20 times a week. I have the only broadcast about books and writers on a daily broadcast in the United States, and it reaches a mass audience in several stations.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't convinced, so I played him a couple of excerpts there, and he finally got... Well, he wasn't completely convinced. Well, he was still skeptical.
How many times a day are you on?
I'm on 3 times a day, Monday through Friday.
And what hours? I got to catch this thing.
I will give you. Okay. I will give you the.
You haven't caught it yet?
No, I got. I don't know.
Oh, you went yours, really?
Yeah.
I will give you a.
We can have a cassette, right?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And it's on 5 times on the weekend. And I notice they're sometimes using it as a filler on the weekend too. So I get a few extra plays when they run short of copy.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about you, and let's talk about Dorfman's CBS. As soon as I opened this book, and I saw this beautiful artwork. Some people would say, well, no, these are illustrations. This is graphic art. It's not art as such. Well, I don't believe that at all. I think that this has as much legitimacy in terms of beauty and style as any kind of art you can imagine.
It's applied art. It has, I think, Bill Bernbeck, I suppose, said it better than anybody. It's not as though it is... to be considered as a high order of art as much as it takes artistry of a kind to do that level of work. Not so much for the aesthetics and the cosmetics, at least from my point of view. I view that as problem solving. Were these appropriate solutions to specific problems? And they have marketing problems, CBS personality problems, problems that might be applied to how do we want to be perceived in, let's say, in Washington or with our affiliates. How do they perceive us? How are we perceived in by women's groups, academic world, so forth?
I have to tell you that over all of the 20 years that I've been at CBS, I've seen the ads, I've seen the brochures, I've seen the pictures, and some of them I like, but I never thought very much about them because I'm looking at the information they're telling me.
That's what it's for.
And I guess I assumed that this was done by some advertising agency someplace. Yeah.
We were one of the magnificent organizations, at least for the 35 of the 40 years that I've been here. We ran an inside-the-house advertising agency and design studio and film studio and packaging. We did it all inside.
How do you get your mind to switch from one concept to another? I mean, for example, the brochure or the pension plan is certainly a lot different than...
You know, I don't know that I think about how do I switch from one thing to another as a designer who enjoys, in fact, working... in a broad spectrum of problem solving, I just jump from one to the other. For example, you're looking at some. You just have. We're on, aren't we?
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
For sure.
Well, it's difficult to talk about.
I waste nothing.
Okay, it's difficult to talk about what you're looking at. You happen to be looking at a terrific page of good radio ads. That goes back. Those things must go back to the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I would still do them if I were faced with the same problems. Advertising, space advertising, whether it's on television, radio, or in print, calls for a different point of view and the wearing of a completely different hat than some of those little brochure or personnel folders that you were looking at a moment ago. Advertising is to be a tight marriage of copy concepts and whatever illustration would be appropriate to further the concept. But it's not, it's, you know, we're not dealing with painting, we're not dealing with art per se. We're dealing with visual imagery that attracts and holds and maybe grabs people.
But
and the copy is just as important as the visual art.
That, well, that's true. It's aimed at a different audience. It's not designed to hang in a gallery. And yet, I was over at, which museum was it? It wasn't the Frick. It was one of the graphic design museums up on Upper Fifth Avenue. But there was a showing of posters from, I believe it's the Art Students League, or the outfit on 23rd Street. These were gorgeous.
Oh, the School of Visual Arts,
School of Visual Arts. Mm-hmm. These were Subway posters.
Yeah.
And it was a collection of Subway posters going back, 15 years.
50s, actually.
And the artwork was absolutely gorgeous.
First rate.
Yeah. Yeah. They could stand by themselves.
Sure.
If they didn't have the ad underneath it, mm-hmm. they could stand mm-hmm. by themselves.
Yeah. No, this is, don't misunderstand what I said. In some instances, excuse me, there's a level of artistry that indeed can be called capital A-R-T, art, and particularly in posters. I think I have some posters in there somewhere in the back of the book that, in my estimation, would fit that category. Photographically speaking, we haven't been speaking photographically, but I'm launching into that because there's a good deal of photography in the work you're seeing there. And some of these photographs are absolutely first-class examples of, well, a kind of a high order of art.
Mm. The Wizard of WOR. How'd that get in here?
We were in a cassette business.
I know.
And that was the Wizard of War. Happened to be
unfortunate title.
Yeah.
Oh, just parenthetically, I recall that Toulouse-Lautrec did posters.
Sure.
Early graphic art.
So he did.
It hangs
absolutely.
In the Louvre.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So that beats, that certainly defeats the position one takes that this stuff can't be art. It certainly can.
Now, in this beautiful, this gorgeous book, are photographs, in effect, charting your work through a 40-year period.
Right.
How did you happen to have all these pictures? It would seem to me that a lot of this would be perishable, that you would lose it. But you must have studiously kept a record of everything.
I'd love you to visit my office. You'll see neatness personified. My place looks like it was hit by a hurricane and has looked that way for 40 years. We have a fairly good filing system. One of the reasons I have those pictures, that one, for example, that you're looking at, that happened to be a feature article in Industrial Design magazine way back in the 50s. They simply were doing an article on CBS graphic design, and I was the guy. And I think you'll find that all the pictorial, where I am involved, all those photographs are photographs that were taken for specific publicity situations that were not generated by me, but were generated by publications.
Well, I would assume it's in every artist's interest to keep a portfolio anyway, and to keep his resume current.
Yeah, I don't. It must be. I never did because this was home. I just hung out here so long. I figured they'd carry me out. What do I need a portfolio for?
Well, we go further than posters and ads. We go to actual design with regard to the CBS facilities themselves.
Right.
Tell me, now, one of the most beautiful buildings in New York, of course, is the Saarinen building, the CBS building. I moved into it a year after, well, I guess people were still in the process of moving in when I came here. Tell me about your role in this building, how this came about, and why the CBS building is so unique.
The CBS building is unique. Not just because because it was Eero Saarinen, and it was Eero Saarinen's first and only skyscraper, but that doesn't make anything unique. It's unique because it is a magnificently conceived and designed building. And the magnificence of the building came about because of the strong interaction with the architect between Frank Stanton, then president, and William Paley. And these two gentlemen first of all, they built what was a great company, maybe it still is. The envy, I think the envy of so much industry here and abroad, and that goes for the work we did. From Frank Stanton's office and from Paley's office, one could feel the vibes and the signals that indicated that we want first-class work done around this company. I mean, the absolute best. You know, Paley was very interesting all along. There's one thing, I said this to him last week, we were having lunch. I said, I learned one great thing from you. You always believe that you can do superb work, first-quality work, turn out first-quality product. People will argue about that in terms of some primetime television programs, but nevertheless, he believed in first-class product in every category, news and entertainment and so forth. And his thesis was, people beat a path to your door. That is, there is no contradiction between profitable commerce and high standards. It's simple as that. And he just kept expanding that thing. And I never believed that when I was a kid. I said, well, you got to do schlock work in order to make a lot of money or pull a crowd. He never believed that. And we were that kind of company. We did really good work, for the most part, and were very profitable.
We're also the company that gave us the Beverly Hillbillies.
Okay, but in that category of stuff, it was pretty good.
I suppose. Yeah, I suppose.
I may be saying that just for this.
No. Well, we're not here to talk about it.
What do you think of Mary? You know, Mary Tyler Moore and yep. All in the Family and Red Skelton and all those kind of wonderful comedy programs, which is a very difficult form, as you know, and the those early fabulous documentaries out of the news division, radio and television, Fred Friendly and the, what was his big series?
See It Now.
See It Now was one of them. CBS Reports. These are marvelous things happen on our air. In so many areas, and sure, there was a lot of the other stuff that crept in.
Well, let's go back to what we're really here to talk about, and that's
the building.
The building and the design. I'm interested in one of the most beautiful typefaces is the one that CBS uses
yes,
for just about everything.
Yes,
tell me,
it's
what's the name of this typeface?
The original typeface goes back to the 1700s, and the official name of the typeface is D-I-D-O-T, and it's simply named after the man that originally designed it. When we began our move to this building, I decided that was going to be our official typeface. You notice that CBS, the corporate body, we do not have a trademark. Our trademark is simply those three letters, CBS, in that Dido typeface. I took the original 17th century type, which was very charming and very handmade looking, kind of crooked and stuff. And I made it much more rigid, tightened it up, if you will.
How did you
kind of commercialized it?
How did you find it to begin with?
Oh, I knew that it existed in old typefaces.
It was a well-known typeface.
It was a well-known typeface within limited circles of typophiles, mm-hmm. people that love type, and designers, you know about it. And so it became our official face. It is our official face. It's known as CBS Dido at the type shop where we do our typesetting.
When it's printed on stationery, does it always come in the same color, black?
Not necessarily. Our stationery, it's gray. It happens
right.
to be gray on the
stationery. Because I just happened to see the reason I ask is that I thought somebody might have been rebelling because I got something, I believe, from the investment plan. I could be wrong. I haven't read it yet, and it was blue.
Well, there's not that much rigidity. I've never applied that kind of rigidity to the use of the type. I could do it in any color I want to.
But you did apply rigidity in terms of
letterheads. I did in letterheads, and I did in what I call corporate housekeeping materials. Very rigid. I mean, there is a standard and a unified program, and there's some funny stuff with that stationery. You can see that piece of stationery down there with all the red markings on it. I don't know whether it's still happening, but every box of stationery goes out to this company, goes out to every secretary in the company, has as a top sheet that one page which is a guideline on how to type a letter. And I I caught hell from secretaries, I want to tell you. And they, you know, I was known as the Adolf Hitler of design.
I would think they would like it. They would know exactly what to do.
Yeah, but no one likes that kind of discipline stuff. No, not at all.
Well, whenever
some of them did.
Whenever I use a stationery type of letter myself, I always miss the dot.
The dot's pretty hard to find.
I always get it below the CBS watermark, too.
Remember a very cute note from one of the secretaries. Said, if I ever catch you near the secretary pool, I'm going to drown you.
Tell me about some of the other things in the building that...
that mural, for example.
Yes, the mural.
I recall very vividly standing in that empty space, which is our cafeteria with Frank Stanton. And Florence Knoll was, she's not in business anymore, is Knoll Associates. You know who they are, quite well-known furniture designers and manufacturers. She did the interiors of this building, and she's a very superb interior designer. And I'm just no more than an interior designer, a superb furniture designer. We were standing in that space, and I pointed to this big, white, empty wall, and I caught Stanton's attention and said, Frank, I think that wall needs some treatment. I would love to do something with that wall. And he said, well, what would you do with it? And Florence jumped in and said, gee, that's a good idea. Why don't we put some old maps of New York on the wall? And I wasn't pleased with that idea, and I said so. And I think what was shot back at me was something like, okay, wise guy, what would you do? I said, I have maps, you don't need maps. What would you do? And I said, well, give me 30 seconds. That was pretty arrogant. Give me 30 seconds, I'll think of something. I had made for Stanton a birthday gift. It's something called a California job case that's known in the typographic world when typography was lead, metal. It's a job case that looks, it's a drawer, you know, California job case. It's a drawer full of little cubbies and looks very Mondrianish. You know, so if Mondrian had drawn a broken up a space of that dimension, he might have done it that way. And all the little bits of type were in each cubby. There are more A's in the alphabet, in words, or in E's, than there are X's and Z's. So the X and Z boxes are small, and the A's are big. And so it makes a kind of lovely, as I say, Mondrianish pattern. I had filled one of those with wood type, old wood types, and metal types of various sizes, and presented it to Frank Stanton for his birthday. And it had the box I had prepared of typefaces were full of 5121 memorabilia, everything to do with the building. And that was buried somewhere in my subconscious. And when Frank said, what would you do? Well, what if you're not going to do maps, what are you going to do? And I said, give me 30 seconds. Well, in less than 30 seconds, I remember coming back saying, you remember that box I did for you with all those type things? I could see that wall as one big white wall full of white cutout letters in different typefaces. And I think I'd like to put food objects in the wall. I mean, just like that. I had a picture of it. And he said, Frank, who was terribly perceptive, that's an oxymoron. Is that terribly perceptive? It's got to be an oxymoron. He said, it's very perceptive. He said, it's a wonderful idea, and why don't you make me a sketch? I guess he wanted to show it to Paley. And I said, oh, what a sketch. You know, 250 different typefaces.
It'll take you 2 days
to draw. It took more than 2 days to do a very rough sketch. And I showed it to him. And he came back and said, you know, go right ahead with it. And what was magnificent is he never said, I never heard him ask these questions. He never said how much. Well, they knew I was the stingiest guy in the building, so they never asked how much. But it's unusual for a client not to say how much. And he didn't say how much. And that thing, I couldn't do that for $350,000 today. And I think we paid the dumb guy that I asked to cut out the letters for me. I designed it, of course. And the dumb guy that cut out the letters wanted $7,000 for these things. And I said, you're crazy. I'll give you $11,000. So he loved me immediately. He's an old friend of mine. And then when he was finished, he came back and said, It cost me 15. I said, hey, I gave you 11. I can't go back. And so I sneaked a few more dollars for him. Anyhow, but that's that. I priced that for someone else who wanted a war like that. And I said I wouldn't do it because I had done it. And it priced out at $350,000. But then that's true of everything, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, what happens if they ever remodel up there?
That almost happened.
Can they take the wall out?
Well, that almost happened. They were going to tear the cafeteria apart, you know, and
yeah,
enlarge it.
Job of it.
And enlarge
as
it.
Well, they did it that as it was, you know. It doesn't look that good now.
No, it doesn't. But we were going to enlarge it considerably. And they came to me and said, gee, that mural of yours is in the way. I said, come on, you're crazy. They said, well, we got to get rid of it. I said, Museum of Modern Art will take it, because they wanted it then. And I was gleefully thinking, gee, maybe they do, maybe they're serious about dismantling that thing. And I had it promised to my alma mater, Cooper Union. I told them that this mural is coming down. Would you like this thing at Cooper Union? I said, oh, boy, would we. But fortunately, we just left it intact, left it alone.
Lou,
it comes off the wall easily, incidentally, panel by panel.
Yeah. So
they hang on clips.
Why don't we have the CBS coffee cups anymore? That was such a nice touch.
You're right. I guess they were expensive. There's a lot of stuff we don't have anymore.
It's class.
Yep.
What other things?
Even the sugar and salt dispensers were CBS sugar and salt packets.
Yeah.
That was called... That was, at that time, that was known as complete design, you know, fully integrated design. You know what we did here in this building then without knowing it? We were creating an entirely new industry for other people. There are many people around that design organizations who specialize in what they call corporate identity programs. And it's a very, very big, big lucrative business. And I could name half a dozen zillionaire companies that do this for design companies who perform these duties for corporate organizations. We were doing all that without knowing we were doing it. Or we didn't. I mean, we had no name for it. We were just doing, under Stanton and Paley, we did what was right. That was what was wonderful about it. We did what had to be done because it was right.
Now, you don't do all of this yourself, do you? I mean, don't you farm out this stuff? You work with
people?
I have
an art department.
But
I conceive whatever is in
the idea.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I stole those out of Paley's office. He's got a collection of mics, and I use them for the 50th anniversary annual report.
Those
are his mics. Most are his mics. I pulled a stunt on that one because I knew that some of the old-time engineers, when they retired, they took old microphones with them, which weren't being used. And what I did was an interesting trick. We went on the ham radio, because they're all ham radio nuts, and we did a commercial to all our people, all our engineers. Hey, fellas, please, if you got an old microphone, when you come back, can we have it? We need it for photograph. And by God, they showed up.
Microphones don't look as good anymore.
They certainly do not. I said that to the Paley the other day for the museum broadcasting. I knew. Do you remember that exhibit? I had a wall of microphones at Museum Broadcasting.
No, I never saw that.
Oh, God. Some guy in Minneapolis collects microphones, and he's got the darndest collection of fabulous-looking mics I never knew existed. And we borrowed the thing from, we borrowed the set from for about 2 years and built a big display, and it was on the wall of Museum Broadcasting. We are trying to buy that from him for the new Museum Broadcasting.
Are you having a role in the design of
it? To a degree. I'm working with the architects, Philip Johnson.
Now tell me about the book and how this book came about and how you were able to get all of this material together.
Yeah, well, getting the material together is not all that difficult. We do have relatively comprehensive files, and in my case, going back to 1946. I always manage to hold on to everything and have a few copies of virtually everything and try to maintain a filing system where I can get at stuff. There's historical significance in a good deal of this, incidentally. I'm going to give a bunch of it to the Museum Broadcasting for their archives. The book came about because a publisher came to me and said, hey, what about a book? How about a book about you and CBS? You've been there since the Ice Age, and there's no one around that's been in your position in a large corporation for that length of time doing this kind of work, and it seems as though it would be a nice, interesting story. And on top of that, not just the longevity part of it, the fact that for 50 years, this place has been known for its distinguished graphic design, and it's public relations through its messages, its visual and written messages.
And Dick Hess and Marion Muller.
And Dick Hess is a friend, yeah, a good friend of mine who I said I didn't want to do the book because I don't know if how objective I could be. Wouldn't it be nice to have someone I respect pick and choose pieces and put the book together? And Dick Hess is a very good art director and designer, and I thought, well, what the heck, I'll go by his eye. We fought like cats and dogs because I didn't agree with a lot he did. And then I realized then that I should have done it myself. And Marion Muller is a very good advertising writer, an old friend, and she knows me very, very well. And I thought, well, it's nice to have somebody that kind of knows you socially and unsocially and whatever, and let her do it.
That's pretty etched on this glass.
Yeah, that was a very nice.
Lou Dorsman, this is.
So that's a span, and that span's about 40 years worth of stuff.
40 years.
Yeah,
yes.
And what?
In many respects, it is a companion to the history of CBS.
It traces really
many of the visual
really
aspects
is.
That people
yeah.
don't realize
yeah.
that are there.
Yeah, Morley Safer said something interesting about that. I don't know how. Well, he said exactly what you're saying. He said, "Gee, it sure brings us back. Sure brings me back, and it's a little sad." Because there's stuff in there that's reflective of a kind of, from his point of view, of a kind of programming that we did in days gone by. CBS reports on where we tackled tough subject matter, which we don't, we sort of don't touch.
Actually, just parenthetically, our programming is better today. The reason that he remembers these broadcasts is that they broke ground.
They broke ground.
And now we do them, for example, many of the things that
broke
ground on 60 Minutes are just, they're shorter,
yeah.
But they do them on a regular mm-hmm. basis. Mm-hmm. It would be months or years between these groundbreaking broadcasts.
That's true. But when you get back to Pentagon Papers and Hunger in America and some sensitive material, there's not much of that. I don't think there's much of that around. Sensitive material today would be not taking off on the government, but AIDS and Lord knows what other wonderful subject matter you have around to work with if you want to.
Well, this is certainly a beautiful beautiful book, and people who like graphic arts and design and art in general, I think, will find
actually,
this fascinating.
Yeah. I insisted that it be done at a level, and that is not at a level that one looks down to, that it be done with clarity to the extent that it would be a superb piece for students, art students, design students, advertising students, one, and two, for public relations people and advertising managers, directors, or whatever in larger companies, and it becomes in effect a learning instrument. It's a tool.
It's a beautiful book, Lou Dorsman. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you
for coming
very
down
much.
And chatting with
I enjoyed being here.